The Council for a Free Australia invite you now to listen to Frankie Schaefer give a forthright talk on a very delicate subject, babies by the bucketful.
Frankie Schaefer is the son of the late theologian Dr. Francis A. Schaefer, who, perhaps more than anyone else, molded a generation of young people to believe the Word of God and obey it. Frankie, like his father, has upon his shoulders the mantle of a prophet. When you hear this man, you hear a prophet of God. That is not my opinion. That is the opinion of countless people across our nation. He's a filmmaker. He's an artist. But more than that, he's a prophet. He speaks to the real issues and the real questions addressing all Americans today. His latest book, A Modest Proposal, taken from the title of an essay by Jonathan Swift, penetrates deeply into much of what's wrong with our country and our world. I hope that you'll buy a copy and read it, as I did the other evening. It's our great privilege to present this prophet of God, Frankie Schaefer V. Give him a warm welcome.
Thank you very much. Please be seated. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight. And before I begin, let me just say this. It is not often that I have the luxury of speaking to an audience that is as warm and receptive as this. Basically, my only request, therefore, is if you like what I'm saying, don't actually charge the podium. I'm a little bit... You're so warm and receptive, I don't know if I'm going to get out of here alive. So don't get carried away there. Just applaud. Don't throw heavy Bibles at me or anything else. I'd like to speak to you tonight about something that is a great concern of mine, and that is simply the century in which we live. This is not an abstract idea, because after all, we live here. The 20th century is our own century. I think one of the problems with the church today, fundamentalist, evangelical, charismatic, Catholic, whatever, indeed, the whole people of this country, is that they have failed to understand the language of their own time. If a missionary were to go to a foreign country, say Uganda, or to some place such as France or Belgium or Germany, and did not bother to learn the language of the nation to which he or she was going, he or she could scarcely be surprised or blame the surrounding culture for his or her failure to communicate the truth, let alone any other ideas. We as the church have failed to understand the basic nature of our century, and we are proving our failure with the dismal results, or rather lack of results, we are achieving in changing not only this world, but more specifically our own nation, or even halting its onward rush towards what I think many of us see as truly a scenario of doom, finally. What is this century of ours, then? Well, you know, every century is remembered for something. One thinks of the Renaissance in Italy and in Europe for its great art. One thinks of the 19th century as a time of industrial revolution. And as the centuries pile one on another and recede into the dim corridors of history, they lose their detailedness, and all we remember about them is certain characteristics, like hooks on the wall we hang our coats on. There are pegs we remember about them. We don't remember the details. I don't think, as we try to figure out what our century is, that when people look back, it will be remembered for its great art. Somehow, I cannot picture in a museum 200 years from now, serious students of art studying reruns of Charlie's Angels, for instance. I do not think that it will be remembered for its technology, for the simple reason that if we continue at our present pace, the 21st century will outstrip ours in exactly the same way the electronics of our age have dwarfed the achievements of the steam engine and even the internal combustion motor. What then is this century, and what will it be remembered for? I think that above all else, unfortunately, what we will be remembered as are the people who populated the world during the century of genocide. The 20th century is indeed unique. It has one awful and tremendous achievement, and that is the killing of innocent human life for political, socioeconomic reasons on a scale never achieved before in the history of mankind. Attila the Hun at his most vicious would not have dreamed of such a scale of slaughter. The Romans, in their expansion across the whole known world, would not have contemplated at their most bitter and sour moments the massacres of our era. Indeed, the great conquerors of history, Napoleon and Alexander the Great, never, ever left in their wake the trail of death that even casual rulers in our own period of history have left behind them. Our century began with the slaughter of the Armenians by the Turk. They were slaughtered because they were the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they were inconvenient to someone. They were not killed because individual Armenians had committed some crime that they had to be punished for. They were not killed because they were robbers or villains and eating a disproportionate share of the food or in some other way endangering the population. They were killed for ideological reasons of hatred. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. As the century progressed, in 1917, we find someone sitting in Zurich, Switzerland, writing letters to his friends in Russia. And soon a sealed train car is sent through Germany at the end of the First World War with this man inside on a fateful destiny, and his name was Lenin. And Lenin went into the Soviet Union and started a revolution. And within 6 months of the beginning of that revolution that he committed in the name of ideology, we find the Cheka, which was the great granddaddy of today's KGB, in full swing in operation. And the Gulag Archipelago, that prison system that by its thousands of encampments has dotted the Soviet Union from 1917 to our own day, from the Ural to Siberia, from Moscow to the Black Sea. The Gulag was in place. And the tramp of the boot of totalitarianism rang in every village and hamlet and city. Lenin started the slaughter of a whole people, a class of people. Again, not because of some crime they had committed, but simply because in his idea of history, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time and were no longer needed and had to be eliminated. Not because of any individual or personal guilt, but simply because of a political philosophy which wanted, in his case, to do away with the middle class. Not satisfied with this, the terrorists that followed him, a man by the name of Joseph Stalin, began to kill off even those who had first made the revolution, the peasantry and the workers. In fact, Stalin starved to death deliberately by removing the seed grain and then sealing off the entire area. 7.5 million peasants in under 5 years in the Ukraine, and this was only a beginning. This was only a beginning. Across the border of the Soviet Union, someone admired Stalin very much. His name was Mao Zedong. Mao Zedong, in his quest for the perfectibility of mankind without religion, pursued a killing program that took, by some estimates, more than 100 million lives. As these upheavals, as these slaughters were continuing, not satisfied with what was going on in the East, mankind produced new leaders in the West. Adolf Hitler strode onto the stage of history with a program for the perfection of the human race. It was a good program, and it worked well. It was well-intentioned. In fact, many of those who carried it out were nice people, law-abiding citizens. Some were even churchgoers who called themselves Christians. It was the Nazi program of Holocaust. And it began not with the slaughter of the Jews, and not with the gassings in Treblinka and Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz and Mauthausen, what have you. It began with an idea exposed by Leo Alexander, who was the prosecuting psychiatrist at the Nuremberg war trials. And he said that the Holocaust began with the idea that there is such a thing as a life unworthy to be lived. And when that idea was accepted, the door to the Holocaust was open. And it is interesting to note that in Germany, it was not the SS, it was not the marshals of the Third Reich who started the Holocaust. It was the doctors and the lawyers and the professors of psychiatry in the German universities in Berlin and other centers of learning who began the Holocaust by first opening the door to the idea that lives were unworthy to be lived if they fell below a certain standard of either handicap or mental retardation, and then carried these ideas out by beginning to practice euthanasia in Germany. And history records that it was the handicapped and the weak and the infirm who were the first to be eliminated by the Third Reich when it came to power. Not as a new program that it had cooked up in its Nazi fascism, but as an extension of the philosophy of its own universities, the departments of psychiatry, philosophy, medicine, and law in its own university and academic community. History rolled on. The gassing of the 6 million Jews passed from the scene, and the Nuremberg war crimes trials were held. And at those trials, American judges presided. American lawyers were prosecutors. American psychiatrists like Leo Alexander functioned on the basis of bringing these criminals to trial. What were the criminals of Nuremberg tried for? They were tried for crimes against humanity. This is how it was put. Not merely trivial individual crimes, a mugging, a rape, a murder, a theft, bad as those might have been. Not even traditional war crimes, the excessive plunder of a city or village, the shooting of a few civilian hostages, sad as that was, but something far more heinous, something on a grand scale called a trial of those who had committed crimes against humanity. It was seen that what they had done not only threatened the individual Jews and Slavs and handicapped that they had killed, not only threatened those who they had slaughtered in their push into Russia and starved and trampled, but it involved the whole of humanity, because their idea of social engineering to make human beings perfect, even if at gunpoint and gas chamber, was so evil that their crime was seen as a crime against humanity. And after that period of history, it was thought that the eugenics movement, which is the idea of social engineering and human engineering, playing with human beings as if they were bits of putty or clay or bits of steel and iron from which one can build a bridge, was forever buried. And that outside of the Soviet bloc, in which the same philosophy was continuing even as the Nuremberg trials went on, that at least in the West, in what was regarded as the West in contrast to the East, in what was regarded as the bastion of civilized and Judeo-Christian thinking, such ideas would never be practiced again as long as Nuremberg and its crimes were remembered. And yet, a few short years later, the same American judicial system that had hung by the neck until death, people like Dr. Mengele of Auschwitz, who experimented with babies, the same judicial system that approvingly stood by while Israel hounded down Eichmann in South America and kidnapped him to bring him to trial in Tel Aviv, to hang him and then to scatter his ashes from an airplane, since they did not think his body fit to bury in Israeli soil, so great were his crimes. The same judicial system that had stopped these acts and had fought a war to close Auschwitz and to forever roll back the idea that the human race can be engineered at a whim. This same judiciary, in one Justice Harry Blackmun, produced a criminal class of its own, which seemed bent on rivaling and indeed surpassing the crimes of the recent history of Europe. And onto the stage for the first time in history strode true criminal forces of a historic proportion. Not merely misguided people who for a few years introduced Jim Crow laws, then to be overturned by the enlightenment of their fellow citizens. Not slaveholders who could be beaten by a civil war and their slaves released. Not fools such as the Supreme Court, who in their Dred Scott decision had declared black chattel property, only later to be reversed. But the very heads of government who, in the name of humanity itself, declare black, white, male, female, bright, retarded, well and handicapped, unborn children, all as non-persons, if they got in the way of a social engineering eugenic concept, this time not of race, but of convenience. In Hitler's Germany, you became an enemy of the state and liable for punishment and then death if you were of the wrong race. The historic criminals in this country, people like Harry Blackmun, went further. And they said that you become liable for your life if you are a mere inconvenience. And at that point in history, with the stroke of a pen in which all 50 states had their laws against abortion overturned, laws that had stood since the beginning of the founding of this country, laws that stood in the tradition of the British common law that went back to the 12th century, and its laws that stood in the tradition of all Christian Europe back to the fall of Rome, and its laws that stood in the tradition of the sanctity of life of the Jewish people all the way back to Abraham, and its laws that stood in the light of the sanctity invested in every human life back to the book of Genesis and the mark of Cain, with the stroke of a pen, were struck from our nation. And our nation joined a very peculiar and fraternal brotherhood, and that is the brotherhood of the social and human engineers who stand as historic criminals, condemned not only by those who live today, but forever and by history. In some future museum, some years hence, in a more enlightened age, I imagine that there will be a room dedicated to the 20th century, much as there are many rooms in Yad Vashem in Israel dedicated to the Nazi Holocaust, in one which can see pictures of all the Holocausts of the 20th century, perhaps photographs of the 3.5 million people that Pol Pot killed in Cambodia for his social engineering and class warfare reasons of revolution. Perhaps photographs of some of those peasants starved in the Ukraine, or an Armenian baby caught on the end of a bayonet. And in that rogue gallery, there will be an American wing, perhaps under a door with an American flag over it. And in that room, there will be pictures of aborted babies, twisted limbs, broken bodies, skulls smashed, faces ripped, skin burned, limbs pulled off, faces defigured. And in that room there will be pictures of people like Justice Blackmun, and they will have inscriptions under them describing what he did and what he opened the door for. They will have pictures of the famous abortion clinic owners. There will be pamphlets on how much they earned in a day from the trade in human flesh, just as there are pamphlets in Yad Vashem describing exactly how much the German high command made from the selling of the gold extracted from the teeth of the Jews before they went to the oven. And this museum will be a hissing and a byword and a horror and a lesson for all mankind, and it will be raised as a witness not only against us and our time, but as a warning to future generations to never go down our path. And just as we now say, when we mean to warn and frighten, if we continue with thus and so action, we will be like the Nazis. Someday there will come a generation in this world, unless Christ comes back first, for the wheel always turns, you know. Evil cannot last forever. And they will say, if we continue down thus and such a path, perhaps in the year 2200 or whatever, We may even get to the point where we have such a disregard for human life that we behave as America did in the 1980s and the 1970s. And it will be our nation that will become the new standard bearer for the depth to which human beings can sink, and a warning against future people. But there is a problem here. There is a problem. And that is that in the midst of this time, There will also be questions by any believers who are living then. And they will simply say this. They will say that they had searched the archives and found that at the same time that Roe v. Wade was declared, at the same time that it became legal to burn a baby to death in its mother's womb, its first and most secure home, the first home of our Lord Jesus Christ, that there were 50 million evangelicals in that country who could have formed a voting majority bloc but did not bother, who could have picketed abortion clinics into the ground but did not do so, who could have stopped every single last killing by actions of mercy and compassion, by starting chains of crisis pregnancy centers that would cover the country like beacons of light in a dark night, each church having a hotline, so that every pregnant girl or woman with a difficult or unwanted pregnancy would think first of the local church automatically instead of a Planned Parenthood and others who are paid to kill babies. But they did not. And there will be a great question. There will be a great question. And it will be debated in future theological schools endlessly, I am sure. And that is simply this. Of those 50 million evangelicals, were there any who were real Christians? Because the evidence will point to the contrary. In exactly the same way that we look with the degree of unbelief and horror at those who during the era of slavery even had the audacity to preach sermons, saying that the black man was not a human being and therefore could be caught, enslaved, trapped, and made to work the fields like a dog. There were such sermons preached. We look back in horror. We say, how can this be? Did they not have the word of God available to them in which Christ said that we must do unto others as we would be done by? Did they not have the word of God that said that we must love our neighbors as ourselves and suffer the little ones to come to Christ? And we look at horror at our slaveholding forebears and we say, how could they do such a thing? But do you realize we have surpassed them? Do you realize that no bigot in Charleston Bay ever conceived of an evil to the degree that we have tolerated? For he, at least, only brought slaves to this country to work them, which was wrong and evil. But to my knowledge, no slaveholder ever bought a ship of slaves merely to burn them to death. To my knowledge, no slaveholder ever enacted a law whose sole purpose was to exterminate a whole nation. And evil as they were, even they never dreamed of this. So we then look back for a comparison to the church in Germany. And we say to ourselves in holy horror, how could the German church have been so silent? Why were there not more Corrie ten Booms who would break the law in the name of Christ and hide Jews in their attics? And the answer is simple. Look at the evangelical leadership today, who even disapprove of and will discourage, like the Pharisees, who would not come in themselves and prevented others from doing so, will discourage those, for instance, young people in colleges who do wish to do something like start a crisis pregnancy center or picket an abortion clinic. And so as we look back at history and we stand in horror and amazement at the sins of our fathers, their blindness and corruption, in comparison to which it now turns out that in our own time we have a greater blindness. A pathologist, a doctor who works with the examination of tissue, who works with cadavers and bodies and samples and liver biopsies and other such things in his laboratory in a large hospital in Santa Barbara, came up to me after such a speech as this. And he says, you know, a few years ago, I saw your film, Whatever Happened to the Human Race. I saw that movie, and when I did, as a medical man and a pathologist working in a hospital that did abortions, I felt convicted to speak out on the subject and do something, but I'm ashamed to say that I did not. I rationalized to myself how my job depended on this, how I myself was not performing abortions, how even though I had to handle and dispose of dead aborted babies on a daily basis, I myself was not killing them, and if I didn't do this job, someone else would. So what was the use of me protesting? And somehow, he told me that like Pontius Pilate, he felt he could wash his hands of this evil. But he said, about a year ago, something happened to me that finally shook me to my core And I finally realized that to have any part with this and not resist it to the uttermost of my being implicated me totally. He said at the end of each day, when abortions are scheduled in this hospital, a number of buckets arrive lined with plastic bags down in his part of the hospital. The larger fetuses that are not too damaged by the abortion procedure are kept for further study and dissection by medical students. The smaller fetuses are merely grind up and flushed into the sewage system of the city. The medium-sized fetuses that cannot be ground as easily and perhaps would block the drains and yet are not big enough for dissection or experimentation are simply thrown into other garbage bags and taken to the hospital incinerator. A bucket arrives and he opened it expecting the usual grisly contents, and to his amazement, inside that bucket was a living, crying baby that had been aborted about an hour earlier and yet had not died. And on the bucket in the doctor's own handwriting was a note from the doctor to the pathologist instructing him to put the baby for further observation in a bottle of formaldehyde. This cowardly butcher for hire, this killer, this SS guard in a white coat, this slaveholder and grinder of the poor and the least of these for hire, not having had the courage to finish off his grisly trade, wanted to pass off his task to some anonymous person down in the basement, in a white-tiled room far down below the bowels of the hospital where he would not see the end of his work, not having the courage to simply wring the baby's neck or bash in its head, perhaps fearing a lawsuit or an outcry, and merely sent it to a pathologist with the instructions, subtly put, to drown this living child in a bottle of formaldehyde and screw the lid down for further study. This doctor was a Christian and at that point was faced with a choice. And fortunately, I'm pleased to say he made the right one. He picked the child up and went up to the intensive care unit. This baby was so far developed, so far along in gestation, that only 2 weeks later it was released from the hospital and was able to go to an adoptive home. Now, what shook this doctor up? What so shook this doctor up, besides the incident which finally let him realize that we all have to make choices with death? That since Roe versus Wade, on a daily basis, he had been processing babies as old or older than this child, and had somehow been excusing himself from his own responsibility in this grisly business of disposing of the bodies on the basis that, since babies were already dead and he was unable to prevent their death, he might as well just do his job. And when he realized that a baby of the same age or younger than others he had been helping to dispose of was now in a home growing up as a child, suddenly he was convicted of the tremendous evil of what he had done. And on that very day that this thing happened, he walked up into the office and slapped his security pass down on the table and left. And that was the end of his career as a pathologist in that hospital. And he has joined the pro-life movement and fights ceaselessly and vigilantly for the unborn. In Nuremberg, there were many Nazi criminals who presented as their chief defense the fact that they were only obeying orders, that nothing they could have done would have stopped the Holocaust, and that they were simply carrying out things that would be done by others had they not done them. And the defense counsel argued this eloquently. But American judges struck this down on the principle of a philosophy of individual responsibility. Our American judges said, in essence, it does not matter what someone ordered you to do. There are crimes beyond which, if you go, your conscience should have told you that, order or no order, it would have been better to disobey the order and take the consequences rather than obey an order. For instance, to round up a group of women and children, herd them into a truck, put a hose into the back of that truck from the exhaust pipe, and listen to them scratch and scream for 12 hours as they died. And that, orders or no orders, you should have known enough of what your conscience taught Judeo-Christian history and tradition to obey such an order. And we hanged men by the neck for not doing so. Today there are Christians In fact, the majority of evangelicals, or certainly the majority of their leadership, who says, abortion is the law of the land. What can we do? We're not responsible for the direction of this country, after all. We are merely Christian university professors or theologians or editors of magazines, what have you. It is not our business. Since when should we be involved in politics or social questions? Someone else will have to do this. And they stand condemned, and we stand condemned for our inactivity. For let me tell you how I see it. Every abortion clinic or hospital that does abortion, every abortionist office in this country, or every office of a group like Planned Parenthood who proselytizes for and performs abortion, that is not actively, daily protested, picketed, and spoken against by the Church of Christ, might as well have a sign over the door saying, owned and operated with the approval of the local church. There are Christians who are embarrassed to get into this fight for one reason or another. When I started in the pro-life movement, and to this day, I often find myself embarrassed. When I picket a clinic or lead a march, as I did in Kalamazoo against Upjohn, I am embarrassed. But I have made a conscious decision, and that is that I would rather be a little embarrassed now than a great deal embarrassed on Judgment Day. What as evangelicals can we do about this horror? The first thing is to recognize that it is a horror and to stop accepting the lies of the abortion industry. Let me look at a couple of those lies with you. First, think of this one. What about the hard cases, as Mondale and Ferraro constantly alluded to, of rape and incest in the life of the mother? Say, for the sake of the argument, you accepted their view and you said, we will legalize abortion for all such people, which is not what I think. But say you did. Do you know how many percentage points of all the abortions done in a year you would have just made legal? Less than 2%. And yet they talk about the hard questions as if that was what abortion was about. It is not. Since when do we make law on the basis of hard cases? Since when would anybody give hearing to a presidential candidate who argued for the striking down of all the laws against armed robbery because in some cases you have some sympathy for the robber because of some particular circumstance? Since when would we legalize rape on the basis that we had one case in which there was a question or a sympathy for the rapist? And therefore we said, well, because this fellow has a heart problem, because 2% of all rapes are committed by people who either you don't know if they completely compos mentis, they've got some other problem, you don't know if they're really guilty, so we'll strike down all the laws against rape. No laws are based on the exceptions and the hard cases, or you cannot have law. And yet we have accepted a double standard in the area of abortion and the protection of the sanctity of human life we would not accept in any other area, because the abortion industry is based on a basic lie. Another very specific lie is simply this. When does life begin, they tell us. And you say, what do you mean? And they say, well, how can you call a fertilized egg or a zygote human? As a matter of fact, genetic science, etiology, and understanding of what those 46 chromosomes are show us that we can call a fertilized egg human. But let's say we couldn't. You can abort all the fertilized eggs and zygotes you want. Do you know why? None are ever aborted. For the simple reason, a woman does not even know she is pregnant until 4 to 6 weeks later. The average abortions are never done before 6 weeks. In fact, almost none, if any. Abortions are done from the 6 week on. into the 8th, 12th, 13th, 15th, 26th weeks, and beyond. Abortions are done on developing babies with encephalographic brainwaves, independent circulatory systems, their own heartbeats, children who react to light and pain and stimulation. Let me tell you when I understood how graphically they react to light and pain and stimulation. When I watched a new film that has been made and edited by Bernard Nathanson, who used to run the largest abortion clinic in New York City and since has repented of his deed and written a book called The Abortion Papers and another book called Aborting America, and now he's edited a film called The Silent Scream. And in that film, through the technology of ultrasound, in which you can see inside a human internal organ, we see for the first time on film an abortion being done on ultrasound. So now, what was once hidden has been brought to the light, and you can see with your own eyes that this is no blob of tissue. Let me tell you what this zygote, this blob of tissue, this piece of protoplasm, this worthless limb to be amputated like a gangrenous thumb, let me tell you what it does in this abortion. And then you should get the silent scream and study it for yourself. First, let me say this abortion is an average procedure. It is not a late-term abortion, even. It is of a child only 12 weeks along. 3 months, that's all. And let me tell you what this little blob does. First, on the ultrasound, you see this child swimming peacefully in the amniotic fluid. Asleep. And in to the uterus, this first home of all of us. This first lodging place of every human who has ever come to earth, even Jesus Christ. Even Jesus Christ, who God created within a human uterus. This blessed place of life. Into this place comes a sharp instrument. And the child wakes and struggles. And as the suction instrument pursues, this child begins to swim frantically in the amniotic fluid to get away from its sharp edge. And when it is first caught by the edge of this instrument, it is after a struggle. And as it thrashes, the equipment wrenches off its leg. And you see now a little child with one limb missing, thrashing wildly inside the uterus. And let me remind you, this happens 4,000 times a day in this country. This child thrashing wildly, the instrument comes back in again, and now catches an arm which it rips off. But the child still thrashes and refuses to die. And you know, abortionists make money on the basis of how many abortions they can do in a morning. So since it is taking too long, a new instrument is introduced. And I will not give the instrument the dignity of a medical name, though I know its name. Let us simply call it the crusher. The crusher is introduced. It has no place on a medical chart any more than a gun with a bayonet would. The crusher is introduced and grabs this child's head and smashes it. And the child still struggles. But now the crusher is holding its crushed little head as the baby thrashes wildly and the amniotic fluid goes dark with the blood of this child. And the rest of the machinery is introduced, and once again the powerful suction equipment turned on, and one sees the child's whole spine pulled out of its back. And then finally the thrashing stops. And at his leisure, this butcher for hire, this murderer, this killer, dismembered, this innocent human being lays out its remains on a tray to make sure it has gotten all of it. And that is the end of the film. The abortionist who did that abortion, which was filmed on ultrasound, in looking at the movie for the first time narrated by Bernard Nathanson, was unable to watch the screen. What does that tell you? And that is this, that the media and the pro-abortion zealots may pretend that what they are doing is not murder, but the abortionists themselves know exactly what they're up to. In Atlanta, Georgia recently, fertilized eggs and zygotes and other blobs of tissue happened to be surviving abortion procedures so often that at one hospital, the Midtown Hospital in Atlanta, had to issue 14 birth and death certificates because of a Georgia law that says if a baby survives for so many hours outside the uterus, it has to be recorded and its little footprint marked on a page and measured. It becomes official.
They were embarrassed by this. Abortion is called a live birth, the ultimate complication. To prevent this, they developed a new method of abortion called the digoxin-induced abortion. And the Archdiocese paper of Atlanta leaked a study printed at Emory University by their population planning department on the digoxin method. Now there are no more ultimate complications, no more babies in buckets. The abortion is so merciless that he does not want one of his victims on whom he wars to survive. Now a long needle is introduced through the woman's stomach, guided by ultrasound, which now, once a life-saving device, has become a weapon of destruction. And ultrasound now helps the needle be guided into the baby's heart, in which a full adult dose of digoxin, which is a heart-regulating medicine, is shot. But before it is shot in, a large syringe full of the baby's own blood is drawn off to make sure that if the digoxin fails, then at least it will not be fatal to the procedure and make the baby live, because it is literally bled to death through a syringe first. Then the slug of digoxin is introduced. And the end of this report relates that since the beginning of the terminating of pregnancies, as they nicely call it, using the digoxin method in this hospital, the success rate has been 100%, and the first 600 cases were completely successful. And after the digoxin is introduced, 4 hours later, ultrasound is used again to make sure that the heart is not beating. And then the saline poison is introduced. The baby's skin is burned off, and the baby is ejected dead. This blob of tissue, the woman who founded WEBA, Women Exploited by Abortion, did so after she had an abortion in which she was counseled to get rid of what was a blob of tissue. And the first time she thought about what she was really doing was after the saline solution was injected. And she felt her blob of tissue thrash for 4.5 hours as it burned to death. And this woman lay on her back screaming in panic and distress, suddenly realizing in a sickening wave of reality that descended on her, that what she was doing was murdering a child in her uterus. And indeed, when the baby was ejected dead and burned, and she looked into its face and saw its eyes and features and hands and nose and its little feet and its fists curled, she realized that she would have to give the rest of her life to fighting this evil. And so WEBA was formed. The reality of abortion is different than the lies of the abortion industry. If indeed unborn, aborted babies were only blobs of tissue and insignificant, one would think that the abortion industry themselves would be anxious to show us pictures of aborted babies to prove this. And yet, I do not recall seeing large posters outside Planned Parenthood facilities of aborted children. I do not recall feminists parading in front of places they are picketing with signs of aborted babies to prove that these blobs of tissue really do not deserve the attention. No, they hide the facts while they propagate their lies. And one should automatically be suspicious of anyone who tells you one thing but then refuses to show you the facts. And that is what they do. Unfortunately, the church in this matter has a war on two fronts. It would be nice if we could concentrate merely on the abortion industry. But like the French who faced the Nazis rolling over the Maginot Line, we have a rather substantial fifth column in our own midst. Or to put it another way, we have a number of traitors to the cause of not only the pro-life movement, but by extension, the cause of Christ. They are not satisfied with doing nothing themselves. They try to hinder others. For instance, and I will name names here. Oh, hold on a second. For instance, in reading Gareth Jones' book, published by InterVarsity Press, later withdrawn after a hue and cry from the pro-life movement, but not before Erdman's publishers announced last month that they will republish it, Gareth Jones printed a book that had a very nice pro-abortion chapter in it from an evangelical publisher. And in that chapter, which I quoted at length in the, yes, that's right, boo, in this newspaper, There were phrases that would boggle your mind. For instance, Gareth Jones said he was only for abortion in a few rare instances, which is bad enough. It's the same as saying, I am not for the Holocaust, just gassing a few rabbis. That's not being against the Holocaust. That's just being for a smaller Holocaust. But everyone is precious in God's sight. But Gareth Jones lists his exceptions, and they include naturally all the ones you would imagine of hardship, handicapped children, and so forth. But they also include some interesting things, such as having abortions for Christian couples. He says this is all right for reasons, for instance, of financial hardship, marital breakdown, lack of adequate social services, whatever that is. And then, in case you haven't gotten the point, he finishes his list, his laundry list, with the phrase that reads as follows. He says, after the whole list of exceptions and a host of other adverse social conditions. Now, what on earth is a host of other adverse social conditions? Think about that in terms of slavery. I am against going to Africa on the ivory coast, chasing blacks and bringing them back to work at the bottom of my garden till they drop. However, there are a few exceptions to this. Blacks living in abject poverty with a lack of adequate social services, or, of course, blacks coming from families in which there has been marital breakdown, or blacks who happen to have a host of other adverse social conditions around them. And then the evangelical establishment has the gall, when he was criticized by people like me, to fly to his rescue in print and in word, horrified that anyone could criticize someone for taking a slightly different position on this issue that, after all, is just one more social issue, isn't it? What amazed me was the list of people who flung themselves into the defense of this book. People like the head of the philosophy department at Wheaton, who wrote a lengthy paragraph endorsing the book, published by InterVarsity Press after the protests we made as a rebuke to it. And many, many other people. One wonders and wishes that one could find only one such thing on a list. But unfortunately, there are others, and they are by people who should know even better. For instance, one wonders why an institution like Wheaton College, that refuses to take a stand on abortion, even though its own student pro-life groups have asked it to do so now for 6 years, said in an editorial in its newspaper only a month before the recent election, that it was inappropriate for an institution to take a stand on a social political issue. Now, this is amazing in a day and age in which a place like Harvard, for instance, will divest itself of all its shares in stock in companies that do business with South Africa because it believes in that particular cause. And it amazed me on that basis alone. But what amazed me more, and this gives you the temper of the times, ladies and gentlemen, of evangelicalism, was that 1 month after the Wheaton College newspaper printed an editorial saying it was inappropriate to take a stand on abortion, that 18 professors and 3 administrators at that school signed an open letter to the whole student body, which was duplicated 2,500 times so it could be placed in every mailbox in the school, 1 week before the recent national election, urging the student body to vote for the Mondale-Ferraro ticket. Now, that was appropriate, apparently. So it turns out that at Wheaton College it is inappropriate to take a stand on a social or political issue as long as it is a conservative biblical stand, and it is appropriate to take stands that look as if they were penned by a combination of Planned Parenthood, Attila the Hun, and whoever was running Sodom at the time when it was destroyed. So in addition to not taking a stand on the slaughter of the innocent, we have mixed into this noxious brew a level of hypocrisy which is truly staggering. Truly staggering. It is the same kind of hypocrisy the secularists dish out when they tell us that we cannot involve ourselves in affairs of state, because this would be combining church and state, but they are quite free to regulate Christian institutions. It is the same mentality, and it is the mentality of accepting as inevitable the creeping juggernaut of secularism. But we cannot accept this creeping juggernaut, this machinery of secularism, as inevitable. We must resist it. And if we are not joined in our resistance against it by evangelicals who should know better, then let them go about their affairs and let them build their ivory castles. But we will not support them, and we will do more than not support them. We will urge other people to remove their support and give it to people who deserve it. And this has a strong biblical precedent. After David died, there was Solomon. And because he turned away from God, other kings arose, like Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And God looked for righteous people who would carry out his commands in obedience and faithfulness. And if they did not, he would cast them aside and go to someone else. Why? Because he is not interested in religion. He is interested in obedience. And it does not matter how many fine study centers or churches or buildings we build, or what our growth programs are, or what the circulation of our magazines is. If the basic commitment to truth at any cost is gone, it all is sound and fury, signifying nothing. And the church has not survived to pass on its witness for 2,000 years because of professors of theology bent on being fashionable, or professors of sociology or ethics or political science bent on trying to gain acceptance for reading their scholarly papers at secular anti-Christian institutions, and so they trade away the Christian faith for the price of fashion. It has not existed these years because of that. It is ironic, particularly in Wheaton's case, that it was founded by Jonathan Blanchard, one of the great abolitionists of the Underground Railroad to free the slaves, who would be merrily spinning in his grave if he could hear the theology taught in the Bible department, let alone know that the school he founded, faced by another great evil, as intolerable if not worse than slavery, actually editorialized against taking a stand, and then had its professorship and a part of its administration endorse two candidates running on the most anti-Christian ticket that has ever been put together in the history of this country. And at the end of a small comment I wrote on that letter urging Wheaton students by their professors to vote for the Mondale-Ferraro ticket, I simply asked this question. I said, the only thing I don't know is what it was about the Democratic platform in this election they liked best. Was it its endorsement of sodomy or abortion? Where does that leave us? Unfortunately, not having plumbed the list in any way to its depth of what is going on. But suffice to say, there are problems in our own ranks. It leaves us where I said, and that is we are fighting a war on two fronts. On one front, we are fighting for the life of the church, which is being attacked from within by the insidious rot of secularism dressed up as open-mindedness. And on the outside, we are fighting a very vicious enemy who knows exactly what he is up to, first in the form of Satan himself, and then in the form of his servants of this particular day and age, who now arrive not with jack boots and swastikas, but instead in white coats, as professors of gynecology, as politicians who say they represent the party of compassion and yet endorse the tearing from limb of the unwanted. And so we face two enemies, and we fight on two fronts. And here are some practical things we can do. First, in the area of the battle from within, we must insist that once again there is established a basic prerequisite of what it is to be a Christian. And if you step outside of that, you are free to say what you want, because this is a free country, but you cannot use our label of evangelical Protestant to do it under. A company like Erdmann is free to print anything they want, For all I care, they can become the publisher of Hustler magazine, or they can bring out, a book called A Neo-Reform View of Child Molesting, and endorse that in the name of Christ. I don't care, but they should not be allowed by the community of believers to do these things under the name of evangelical. So first, within our own ranks, we have to educate ourselves as to what's gone wrong by reading books like Dr. Lindzell's Battle for the Bible, like my father Francis Schaeffer's book, The Great Evangelical Disaster, and like my book, Bad News for Modern Man, which is about the whole defection of the evangelical leadership away from its roots. And then we must stand against them publicly, because, like all other deeds done in the dark, once the light is shown on them, it is harder for them to get away with it. And if there is a hue and cry, and people asking questions like, what exactly is this theology you're teaching that no longer believes in an inerrant scripture? What exactly is this Christology that no longer will call him the Son of God? What exactly is this social and economic view that looks as if it was written in Cuba? What exactly is this sanctity of life view that could have been penned by Lenin after a bad drunk night on the town? What exactly is this theology? What exactly is this theology that says we can get rid of the handicapped? We have to ask these questions. And if we're silent and we're not willing to take the heat and make trouble within our own ranks, we cannot blame anyone but ourselves if the whole thing goes down the chute. As far as the outward battle goes, let me give you some specific suggestions, briefly. Many of these you've already thought of. First, again, educate yourself. Take advantage of the fact that the Christian activist can come to you free 4 times a year from us, or to anyone else whose name you will send us, or any church or institution. And in the Christian activists are further reading lists and organizations you can join, and articles about what the pro-life movement's doing, and then articles on many subjects, from economics to human life to what's happening in infanticide and many, many other things. Take advantage of this offer since you're here tonight, and see other people do, and send us their names, and we will try to educate them as long as we can with that. Also, read books like the pro-life literature available. And particularly right now, since I'm here, take advantage of this book, A Modest Proposal, which is a fiction satire. And what it pretends to be is a memo from one bureaucrat to another about 10 years from now from the Bureau of Population Planning to another bureau, outlining their plan for the human race. And when you read it, you will see that what we did is, at first it sounds like common sense, the sort of thing you'd read in the newspaper every day. And it goes from there to a completely insane conclusion in which virtually the human race is abolished so it will no longer have problems. And you think that is funny, and it is. But the tragic thing is that is virtually the ethics that are being taught by the abortion industry. If it's a problem, kill it. That's why baby Doe was starved to death. So it's not so far-fetched. And to make that point, we've included real footnotes by real people tied into this fictitious text, as if they were supporting footnotes. And the amazing thing is, the real quotes by people like Joseph Fletcher are crazier often than what my co-author and I could dream up in our wildest imagination. So read this book and use it as a tool to educate other people so that you can introduce them to these ideas in an entertaining and fictitious way that they will read, and with the footnotes and the afterword, really understand what the battle is. But then here are some specifics. There should not be any church in this country or any believer who in some way, I didn't say how or how many hours, but in some way is not involved in the pro-life fight. For it is the fight of the age. There are people who say, but there are many issues. What about feeding the hungry? Well, I would say two things. They must be pretty narrow and limited if they think they can only deal with one thing. We can do more than one thing. However, even if we only could fight one battle, let me tell you something. Do you think that the nation that will starve baby Doe to death in the heart of the grain belt because that child's IQ was too low is long going to have a sanctity of life ethic that will care about doing anything for the poor but getting rid of them? Don't you realize that a country that will abort its babies as we have been doing will open the door to a kind of Planned Parenthood philosophy that, like in China, eventually leads to enforced abortion, for any number of children, some crazy population planner thinks is too much. And if you think that's far-fetched, let me tell you something. In a recent Planned Parenthood booklet that was published this year in London by Planned Parenthood Federation International and quoted in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago, do you know the model they pointed to of population control that they said had done the best job and we should emulate? China. And China has abortion enforced at gunpoint, as documented in Stephen Mosher's book, Broken Earth, in which a pregnant woman with more than one child found walking in the street is literally herded into a truck at gunpoint and aborted, no matter how far along she is. And if that child survives, it will not leave the hospital alive. They will kill it. And Planned Parenthood Federation makes no mention of this and doesn't say this is too far. Because let me tell you, there is nothing too far once you start down this road. And that's why it has to be stopped. Every Christian, therefore, in some way should be involved. What of the nuclear war threat, you say? What of peace and war issues? There is no such thing as a peace and war issue in a country that is already at war. We are at war on 1,500,000 unborn babies a year who are defenseless. It is the most cowardly war ever fought. It is not. And if we want peace and God's blessing, you cannot mock God by asking him for peace for yourself because you are afraid of being burned by a nuclear bomb, and then not fighting for peace for an unborn child who today was burned to death by an abortionist in a saline solution. What a hypocrisy. This is like living at the gates of Auschwitz and complaining that your dishwasher's broken down and that you want this and that and the other, or that you're afraid that the roof will fall in, and never once do you say what's going on inside those gates to other people. God cannot bless this attitude. What are some specifics that every Christian can do in every church? First, the Crisis Pregnancy Center movement. Hotline, so that every woman in America knows that if she has an unwanted pregnancy, she has an alternative to the abortionist. And the difference is that the abortionist will kill her baby for money, but we will save it for free. At the beginning of the pro-life movement, many abortionists would ask me on talk shows and in other venues of debate, well, what would you do about all these babies? And at the beginning, I was hard-pressed because there was very little of any kind of pro-life movement going on except the Catholics. And even they had not developed the full strategies we have now, and sometimes I would say, well, this or that. And now I have an answer. There are more than 3,000 crisis pregnancy centers in this country, and there are more than 4 being instituted or added a week, and there are thousands more hotlines. And yet, it still is not enough. We must do more. However, we have provided a solution. And women do have a choice now, and some churches are reaching out, but more must do so. So that when they say, well, will you take care of these children and these women, our answer is yes. And if someone says to you, well, if you're doing that, how can you be preaching the gospel? They do not understand either the gospel or the pro-life movement. Because if it is not preaching the gospel to save a child from death, to save that child's mother from the worst decision, both clinically and psychologically, she can ever make, if it is not preaching the gospel to share the love of Jesus Christ with her and her child in that way, and then indeed preach the gospel to her, then I don't know what preaching the gospel is. Everyone can be involved in the positive side of the pro-life movement. There are many organizations already existing that need financial support. And if we tithe to send food to the hungry in Ethiopia, we should also tithe to see that our own children are not battered and beaten and starved like Baby Doe was and dismembered. How ironic to send money 3,000 miles or 10,000 miles away and spend none to save the children of our own nation. How ironic for people to say that our nation should send money to the black children of Ethiopia, when blacks are having genocide performed against them by the abortion industry here.
It turns out, and I choose my scholarly language carefully, that the abortion movement is not only antinatal, they are also racist pigs. Newsweek has a cover story on abortion this week. You know why? Because people like you have not been totally silent. And in that story, one of the statistics is to show the disproportion of the number of black girls forced into abortion by zealous social workers who tell them it's better to kill their baby or convince other people that they should be struck off the roles of public assistance and so we should kill their children instead. They are racist pigs and they do it in the name of liberalism. They are not the party of compassion. They are the party of death. We should all be involved. But it is not enough to only be involved in providing alternatives. What of the people who have no alternatives? The children dragged every day into the clinic. There is only one solution to the abortion industry. And it is not to wait for Washington to do its duty. It is not to wait for the Supreme Court to reverse itself. It is not to wait for this nation to be run from the top down, but again to do what Americans have always done at their best, and that is to say, it is we the people. And we the people do not want abortion. And here's what we will do about it. We will shut every clinic in this country if we have to do it, street by street and neighborhood by neighborhood. They will not stay in business. Do you think that if at the bottom of this street, every Saturday and Wednesday, they were holding slave auctions, and there were people chained on a podium down there being sold to work on the farm or cleaning garbage, that it would suffice to say, I'll write a letter to my congressman about it? No, let me tell you something. You would find a way to remove that block. You would find a way to let those slave traders know that in a civilized country founded on Judeo-Christian principles, there is no corner of this land that will hold these people. And they cannot do this. But when it comes to abortion, we say, well, maybe we'll vote, maybe we'll write a letter. It's not enough. And there are some very effective things we can do, and I can't list them all. But some of them are, for instance, picketing them to a standstill. Not once a year, symbolically, but every hour they are in business so they cannot do their business. And if 10 picketers are arrested by a judge who puts access to a sidewalk above human innocent life, then his courthouse should be greeted by 1,000 picketers when those Christians come to trial. And if those 1,000 picketers are arrested, the prison that holds them should be surrounded by 100,000 believers. Our message to the abortion industry is this. We will shut you. Our message to our elected representatives is this. Do you wish to carry on national life as usual? Do you wish this nation to carry on? Then root this evil from our land, every branch and every twig of it, or we will. And in the process, whether it takes 1 or 10 years, we will not grow tired. Because we do not do this to win. We hope we will. We do it because it is right. And we will find a way to stop it. Let me close with this statement. We must understand tactics, and let me tell you the tactics of change. It is not to wait until the whole apathetic majority marches with you. History is changed by a dedicated minority. A dedicated minority that will work harder than the other dedicated minority. And the apathetic majority will go in whatever direction the dedicated minority that outlasts the other one will go. History also is changed. History is also changed, at least civilized history, by the fact that in every age there have been men and women who have looked at the evils of those age, be they slavery or the gassing of Jews, or be it sending 10 and 9-year-olds into coal mines in Britain, and like Lord Shaftesbury, who was a Christian and fought his life against it, seeing that evil, whatever the evil of the moment is, civilizations are changed and remain civilized because good people, God-fearers, speak up. And if they do not, nothing changes, because the world cannot change itself. It is the source of the problem, not the solution. And what we have to remember is this, and that is, as evangelical Christians, we have two duties, therefore. Not only do we have the duty of the citizen, and we're commanded by Paul to be good citizens, and in America that means we, the people, and therefore to be a good citizen is to be a good ruler, because supposedly we have a constitutional democracy, but also we are commanded to be faithful followers of Christ. And for us, therefore, the reason we do what we do is not only to bring change in this country on this particular issue, but also because we believe in a future in which the handicapped child scraped so unceremoniously from the womb and discarded today may someday be your judge. We believe in a future in which every true believer only wants to hear one thing, and that is the words, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." Thank you.
We continue now with an extract from a seminar sponsored by the Council for Free Australia at Griffith University in October 1985, and it's on women exploited by abortion, and the speaker you're about to hear is Dawn, a very moving story she tells.
Privileged today to introduce Dawn. I'm sure that we're all waiting to hear her. Dawn, as I think most of you will know, is the founding member in Australia of WEBA, and also the Australian national president of this organisation. I think you'll be aware that WEBA stands for women who are exploited by abortion, and I think we're all becoming more and more aware of this today. Just recently, when I was in New Zealand taking a speaking tour, I was with my fellow labourers of Above Ruby. Some of you may remember Lois and Janie, and Janie was the one who has written and done the two music records which we've produced with Above Rubies. And she, while I was there, had just found out that she was pregnant with her third baby. She went along to the family planning clinic just to check it out and get it checked to know that she was for sure. And she came back and she was absolutely devastated. She said, "Nancy, I've just come back and got the test," and the woman there said, "Yes, Mrs. Burton, it is positive, you are pregnant. Now, would you like an abortion?" She could not believe what she was hearing. Of course, they'd asked the wrong woman. But she felt and thought of all the other women who would be going in just like her, but not having the convictions that she had, and perhaps just wondering. And of course, they're just put on the spot. Well, maybe I do need one. And that's what we're facing today. And so I'm just going to hand over to Dawn. We're looking forward to hearing her, and I'd like you all to give her a hand. religious, so don't worry. We've got three pamphlets. One is an explanation of what Weber is. It also lists why we say that we've been exploited. This pamphlet lists all the side effects that are associated with abortions and a few extracts from women who have had abortions and healing post-abortion grief for those women who need support and help. Women, as you know, after they have abortions, suffer very serious emotional disorders, which are usually the result of unresolved grief and guilt. This unresolved grief causes a tunnel-like vision. It has the effect of distorting the way in which we perceive the external reality. That is, situations, events, and relationships. The signs of this disorder are an inability to cope with relationships, events, simple tasks, and an inability to make decisions. The personality disorders arising from the side effects of abortion appear to range from very mild to extremely psychotic symptoms. The mild symptoms, the so-called mild symptoms, such as depression, crying, I don't consider it to be mild at all. I don't think there's anything normal about girls or women crying for days on end. Other signs are preoccupation, withdrawal, nervousness, and loss of confidence. These symptoms are the early signs of serious personality disorders. When we start talking about the more serious ones, for example, anorexia or suicidal tendencies, then you're talking about life-threatening situations. Just discussing this on a more personal level, the things that I am conscious of that really affected me during the 20 years that followed my first abortion was the fact that I feel like I've just woken up from a bad dream. I'm very conscious of coming out of this bad dream with the need for a relearning process. Simple things like walking along the sand and knowing that sand feels like sand in your feet. I was conscious that during those years I was relating poorly to people. I couldn't make friends. I was always apologising for not being well without knowing the reason. I would latch on to almost anything to excuse myself from not being able to join in fun situations. There was no joy and there was no peace. I couldn't watch television and I couldn't listen to radio. It seems as though you can't enter into the outside world until the internal disorder has been resolved, and that is the internal disorder created by the unresolved grief. I recognise that when I first started telling somebody that I hadn't had an abortion, that it was a cry for help, which was ignored because no one understood. I really only wanted someone to say, do you want to tell me about it? Or how did you feel about that? Because I think superficially you think that if someone's had an abortion, that's all there is to it. But there is a lot to it. Just even simply being left to go in alone, somebody paying your way, waking up crying, having nurses tell you to shut up because you're disturbing the other patients, what it feels like when you walk outside, the unreality of the world around you, and the fact that nobody understands.
maybe I was just unlucky, because it was such a long time, and it's only been the last few years that I've been able to talk about these things. And when I started talking about it, it may have seemed as though I was getting worse and deteriorating. However, after all the crying was over, all of those things that had been locked up inside were released, and there is a gradual restoration of peace and a slow towards what I would return towards what I would call normal. But those things didn't happen without some rather significant events taking place in my life and dramatically changing the course of my life, one of which was coming into a knowledge of the reality that God existed. It was my experience that when I was told about what I had done, that the reality caused me to have a complete inability to cope. And during that time I developed anorexia and would have died had not some very kind and loving people intervened in my life. I'm going to get away from that just for the moment. The types of numbers that we're dealing with when we talk about abortion are in the range of 90 to 100,000 abortions a year, 30,000 of which are teenagers. The 30,000 are the ones whose pregnancies end in abortion. So to my mind, there has to be a vast number of potentially disordered personalities in the community. We know that's true by the high rate of divorce, the division of the sexes, the increase in homosexual behaviour, the increase in child battering and abuse, and the increase in psychologically disturbed children. Just to go briefly over those, abortion has played a role in the creating the division of the sexes. Women are tired of having their bodies, I'm quoting someone, scraped out. The fleeting pleasure that they gained from this, the casual sexual relationships just hasn't turned out to be worth it. They have developed a deep hatred and mistrust of men. Homosexuality. Women have turned to each other for physical comfort. Their hatred and distrust of men hasn't turned off their feelings. But this further increases their hatred for men. Inwardly, they still recognise their need for men, and they hate them because they need them. Somewhere inside of them is still the desire to be little and protected. Their hatred and aggression towards men has caused men to become impotent and has turned men away from women into each other's arms. Child abuse. There isn't any reason why a man who destroys his unborn child, there isn't any reason why he shouldn't exploit the living child or those following. It doesn't make any sense to disrespect your own child and kill it and then try to protect it from anything in the community. And seeing as the sex is the great king and God in the community, well, why not exploit your own child? And I'm sure you've noticed the age has got lower and lower. In Adelaide recently, on a radio program, a woman rang in rather hysterically about a man who was abusing his four children. His wife had an abortion and she died in the process. I tried to explain to her that that man would not only feel guilty if he had given his permission for the abortion, because probably the abortion was because they had four children and that was enough. So the guilt and the grief that was involved in his life would have been the same as the grief and the guilt that we suffer from. And to my mind, that is the reason why the children are abused and bashed, because of the internal disorder inside that man. And psychologically disturbed children, I've been told about lesbian couples who have children. They have a male child, and the treatment that male child gets, it seems obvious that that child will end up with enormous personality problems. The healing process, if any help is available, is still so slow that there still has to be an imminent effect on any children that are existing. I understand personally the grief and the guilt and the internal frustration and the revenge that you feel inside you. In my case, if you have children after having abortions, we become very neurotic and overprotective women. You've probably already heard about the atonement child, babies, the need to have a baby. It doesn't work, though, because the new baby doesn't replace those who have died. But there is a neurotic need to have another child. For those women who have children and then they have an abortion because they think they've got enough children, they have a different reaction. They inflict their hatred and internal revenge on the living children and their husbands and anyone connected with the abortion. I have seen those children. I have seen children who were previously loved, and I've seen the woman who has had an abortion. And I have seen the hatred inflicted on those children, and the children do not know what's happened to them. They do not understand. The woman herself does not understand why she is hating those children, her living children. And she's hating them because she hates herself. But she doesn't understand that. Family Planning Association, which is comparable to Planned Parenthood in America, I think have a lot to answer for. In Adelaide, a woman rang me and said that the family planning group went to a school. The school sent out a letter to parents and said, we're having this sexual education day, and do you mind if you're happy for your children? This woman had a 9-year-old, an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old. She wrote back and said no, she did not want them to attend, but they did attend. And the children came home, and the 9-year-old told her all about what she'd learnt, and she said they didn't leave anything out, not one single thing. I don't know what was involved, but she said there was everything. Not only that, she said when you become sexually active at 14, 15, 16, you come to us and we'll give you the pill. And then if the pill fails, come back to us and we'll give you an abortion. A social workers' convention in Melbourne last year, a male social worker got up and said, we must encourage our teenagers in their sexuality. For whose purpose, I would like to know. The Right to Life Australian social worker who works at the Action Problem Pregnancy Centre got up and said, are you including abstinence and chastity in your teaching, you know, these children when you go out to schools? And everybody laughed at her. There were two people there who wanted that included, and she was laughed at, ridiculed. There wasn't any mention of letting them grow up or learning to experience relationships, deep relationships with other people. Last week, an 18-year-old Catholic girl, pregnant Catholic girl, went to the Family Planning Association to have her pregnancy confirmed. And when she was pregnant, she was feeling them out. She said, "Well, what would you suggest that I do?" And the doctor said, "I think you should have an abortion." And she said, she pressed him a little bit more. And there was no hint of an alternative. There was no suggestion of her going anywhere else for counselling. It's true what you've said about the doctors. My neighbour had two children and she lost her third one at about 6 months old, and then there was an 8-year gap. When she got pregnant again, she went to the doctor and he said, "Well, you won't want this baby because there's too big a gap." I mean, women are going to doctors all the time and they're not thinking abortion. I believe too, as you do, that acceptance of abortion is the beginning of a dehumanising process which opens up the door to all manner and means of disrespect for life. Even the feminists are horrified to think that fetal tissue is used in cosmetics.
This is where we must leave Dawn at this stage, as the tape is not sufficient to give you the complete story. But there is a complete story on the... The Council for a Free Australia invite you now to listen to Frankie Schaefer give a forthright talk on a very delicate subject, babies by the bucketful.
Frankie Schaefer.